legal and healthcare, they tend to just go steady trend. They don't ride these wild waves like real estate does in valuations. Medicals, guys are just busy all the time, regardless of the market. Attorneys are really busy in good times. They're really busy when people get litigious in bad times.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of speaking with a good mate of mine and a killer when it comes to the world of alternative investing, Mr. Patrick Grimes. And Patrick is the founder of Passive Investing Mastery. He's an Amazon best-selling author, a Forbes Council contributor, and he's a former robotics engineer turned alternative investment expert. And Patrick helps investors build recession-resilient portfolios across litigation financing, energy, and commercial real estate investing. So I'm really pumped and excited to have him on the show today to share his incredible experience and knowledge, particularly in today's investment horizon and field. But enough of me. Let's get him out here. G'day, Patrick. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
I'm great. Excited to be here, Reid. Good old friend here. Get to hang out for a little bit.
I know. I'm going to see you next week at the Mastermind in Scottsdale, right? It's going to be our second. I think you came last year and I don't think you came the year before, but yeah, I'm really pumped.
This will be my third.
Third. Okay. So yeah, so it was. Really pumped to be sitting next to you. But lots happened since we've last spoken to you. So you want to give the audience a little bit of a background on yourself and you know what you've been up to in the last probably couple of years.
Since I've been on your podcast, yeah, that has been a little while. Time flies.
Yeah.
Well, like many of your listeners out there, I was in my case an automation robotics engineer, and now I'm investing in. I've seen a lot of volatility in the last couple of years, right? We've seen some volatility, which happens in normal market cycles over the decades. We've seen, a collapse in some of the fundamentals behind commercial real estate, more specifically in apartment buildings. You know, we've continued to find ways to diversify outside of isolated markets, such as just real estate. And that's really what we focus on. So we've allocated into other industries, which are not affected by similar market fundamentals and swings like the legal industry, medical industry, energy, that kind of stuff.
Take a step back for me for a second and describe, I've known you as a bit of a real estate investment guy, but yeah, as you sort of speak out loud, like your thesis has always been for diversification, right? It's never been to be the operator. It's never been to be someone who is, dealing with tenants and that's historically what we do here at RSN. But as you built your company, was the vision always to be across multiple different investment classes, or did that sort of evolve as you started sharpening your spear?
Man, when I started right out of college, I was making some money, and I went to the founder of the company I worked for, asking, "Hey, what high tech stock should I invest in?" Right, because we were inside all these new fascinating companies with new widgets and. And I figured we had the inside track on all these, speculative, really exciting tech and startups. And I was surprised when he said, you got to go diversify outside of high tech, outside of the stocks and outside of the startups, because that's where you make all your day jobs. So originally, that was the sort of light that sparked the flame of diversification, and which helped build over the years, right? As you know, my first attempt at real estate was before the subprime mortgage collapse. I lost everything. And so, and that helped me learn a lot very quickly about recession resilience and better markets and buying for cash flow and not speculating on new development, pre-development. But so from there, real estate was an allocation for me. It wasn't the end all. It wasn't the end game. It was, where can I put the next bet to build a more well-rounded portfolio? And when you get really good at something, though, tends to take over, right? You get way over allocated in that one thing. So that's been the journey, is getting good at real estate and then figuring out, hey, where else can I invest? And then learning that thing. Okay, well, now I'm feeling a little out of balance here. Let me put another piece of my pie chart in there and make another allocation into something else that doesn't rise and fall with the rest of it. And so that's been the journey for a long time, whether it's, you know, precious metals, energy, real estate, or legal, or now medical, which is what we're getting into. I tend to be gravitating over the years, the journey as you referred to, towards kind of those recession resilient and what we call non-correlated. And that Venn diagram in the center. And I'll add to that now, and which is also a lens that I'm constantly thinking about. And that's what is a little bit insulated from AI disruption. Nothing's entirely, but what is that AI disruptive insulated space that I can overlap those three things and find, hey, here's passive investing masteries, Vivox. This is where we should be allocating and where we should be building our pillars of wealth.
Yep. And you've been gravitated towards, you said, mentioned real estate, you mentioned litigation funds. I also mentioned in the intro, you're in oil and gas. I know you personally, you're in private credit as well. So what does the smorgasbord look for someone who comes to you, Patrick, and say, hey, I want you to, you know, be part of your mastery and what can I eat? Can I have the chicken? Can I have the salmon? Can I have the beef? Like, what do you got on the table right now?
So if you go to our website, you're going to see we've got private credit, which is debt in real estate, more commercial real estate, not so much residential, where you can, the interest rates are real high and it's opportunistic. So that gives you steady cash flow, but it's a private credit. It's a lower risk approach. Then you have the same kind of private credit in the legal industry where we're funding attorneys, ones at very low loan to collateral value with liens, just like any asset-backed lending. And now we're doing medical doctors, hospitals and healthcare through private credit as well, which is receivables, right? Where you can have a very low payment for a collateral value, all very calculated. And those are the kinds of assets where it's just an asset-backed lending or investing strategy that all provide the same kind of processes and underwriting and value but give you completely different sources of returns. Now, I haven't walked away from buying real estate. So we do have an acquisitions fund where we're buying commercial real estate. Not so much multifamily, Reed, because right now I'm still having a hard time getting it to pencil. We've got mostly retail and industrial, warehouse, manufacturing in markets where you've seen a huge resurgence in that, especially during and post COVID, huge resurgence in industrial manufacturing here in the United States, and those tariffs also making a great outlook for that asset class. So don't walk away from ownership in real estate too, but in troubled times, private credit's a really good path.
Yep. And how do you mentioned being at, you know, an asset backed. Let's talk about that for a second. Like the way in which the average investor, at least with my brain, when I talk to my investors, is like, you know, invest in real estate. It's physical, right? It's a piece of land. It's bricks and mortar. So, and then moving into the private credit space, you talk about funding doctors and funding lawyers. How is my money secured in those two different scenarios, on the smorgasbord?
As a real estate operator, you're secured by an equity position on top of a loan, but there's really not much security there. The market can just wipe that out, right?
Which we've seen.
as an owner, right? But as a debt, as a credit facility, you have a much lower position, a lot more volatility, and then you can put a lien on that asset, right? And you can get somebody to appraise it, you can value that asset, and you can put an advancement of an investment amount per collateral value to a level of risk. Just like any other asset-backed lending, attorneys, they have assets, they have corporate assets, right? Which are all their contracts. And specifically, we focus on ones working on contingency that they have a need. They want to provide access to justice for those that can't afford it. And they believe in these cases. They got a lot of skin in the game, like real estate operators. They've got a lot of progress through the court systems. They're waiting settlement. They need access to capital to get more clients or claimants that are similarly harmed or get them across the finish line, just like how real estate operators need CapEx to improve a building and operating expenses to provide housing to tenants. So just like in real estate, you have a collateral value, you get a law firm valuation specialist, you put a lien, a UCC-1 filing, not a deed of trust, against the cross, all the collateral of this attorney. You look for those operators that are attorneys that have experience and skin in the game, and you can deploy and monitor, right? And collect on an exit. You can collect on quite a bit better returns than in real estate. And in legal funding, it's It's actually not just your principal and the fixed interest. It's traditionally a preferred position on a wide variety, thousands of individual cases with upside potential for the investor. After you've paid the settlement to the harm for the majority of the amount, you get kind of upside. So, I mean, that's in those two scenarios, it's actually, those are asset-backed lending strategies. And fundamentally, they're different industries, but all the same mechanisms are there.
Mm-hmm. And talk about those mechanisms, like how do you get the first quote-unquote lien on a lawyer, for example, and this future money that on a case that could be to do with, you know, XYZ, like you don't really care what the case is about, but you just want to make sure that your money is getting paid so he pays you, right? So how do you get in there and be like, well, if something goes wrong, I've got first dibs on that particular money that's coming from a settlement of a particular case.
So we've got to diverge now from just in the general legal industry to what we're specifically doing. Because just like in real estate, there's a million ways to invest in real estate. And there's a lot of wackos like I was doing speculative stuff before 2009 and losing it all. You know, and then there's the other ones that have lost their hair already. Good for you. Mine's gone. But that are doing very late staged, more conservative investments into cases and attorneys that aren't so speculative. You're not going to like 100x your money like in an angel funding, seed investing or venture in a business or a wildcat oil address, but wildcat oil and gas drilling campaign. But you're investing later. And so what that looks like is typically attorneys that have hundreds or thousands of existing clients, people who have signed up with them. They have retainer agreement. They have contingency fee agreements, meaning I'll represent you for a share of the upside. And they've taken these cases through the system. They put together what we'd like to kind of say causality and liability for the most part. Settlement conversations are happening, or there's been already settlements surrounding the case, substantial case law in place. So it's pretty calculated. And you split that up across thousands of individual lawsuits, and it's a business. You know, mm-hmm. The attorneys just can't keep changing their name and setting up shop. They have real business with real collateral, real reputations. And so far, we haven't had any trouble putting a UCC-1 filing, a financing agreement. They're a little slightly different than real estate. We have an attorney that's all he does is legal funding, litigation and funding agreements. He's done $1 billion worth of them. And you put these in place, put a UCC-1 filing, and in the credit agreement it says, here's the actual individuals that this law firm is representing that we have a position in, the contingency fee part, the attorney's share, and then it flows through. It's actually not that complicated. It actually works almost identically to real estate, but it's just a different asset.
No, look, thank you for walking me through that. And I know that was one thing that came to mind as soon as you mentioned litigation funds, like how does your money get protected? So in those types of endeavors, is this a more of a equity multiple or is it a bit more of a cash flow? Or because it sounds like it's more equity multiple because you're sort of waiting for those payouts to occur, or are they coming in so you diversified across so many that they do actually pay out like a dividend every quarter or so?
Other legal funders that are here, we're just cash flow based. We're actually doing just loans and it's interest income. There's others like us where we're not doing that. We're not doing a cash flow based where, and then you just get your capital back at the end. We're indicating we're advancing funds that will be diversified across hundreds or thousands of cases at each law firm. And then all of that is into a fund. And just like if you are a real estate operator and you're like, hey, look, I have I have like 100 plots, right? And I want to build on all of them simultaneously. So like, I'm gonna have 100 operators build each one separately, right? And those are basically like these cases, like these attorneys have taken these cases so far, but they're like, hey, like I'm gonna have all of these settle. It's the case that some of those operators are gonna get done early. Most of them are gonna get done around the right similar time, and some are going to struggle and some may just never get done, right? But that sort of bell curve, right, of distributions is what you find when you have a large diversified portfolio. So while it doesn't say inherently cash flow, because unlike real estate, when you're providing housing to tenants and there's a steady eddy cash flow coming, we're providing funding to attorneys for people who can't afford justice. So there isn't steady eddy cash flow. We're helping the attorney fund their hourly rates, court fees, filing fees, and the ability to get more clients, a big meaner and scarier. So we have to time our investments to only get involved in investments which are near settlement. And some of those we've seen settle in 4 months, 6 months already. There are some that are going to settle in 1, 2, or 3 years. And we typically not go for ones that we expect would settle past that. So we kind of stay in a 5-year time horizon where the majority of it comes back in year 3 and 5.
Gotcha. Oh, great. And you mentioned earlier in medical devices, so you're now starting to, was it medical devices or medical funding? Are they same, part of the same thing?
In medical, like there's a ton of different ways to invest. And we're actually looking at two strategies right now. We're in the process of launching one, which is on the medical receivables side. So it's similar to an attorney where a doctor has done some service. They've have this receivable. It's coming maybe from a hospital. It's coming from an insurance company. It's coming from something. And unfortunately, the way that it's not a litigating process, but unfortunately, the way our healthcare system is they wait to the very last minute to pay those providers. And unfortunately, some of them are 30 to 60, 90 days, and some of them are a year, 2 years, and 3 years out before these providers can get $200, $500,000, $1 million. And it may be a group of maybe 100 people that they spent their hard-earned cash at their brick-and-mortar shop providing care to, and they're not going to get paid for 1 or 2 or 3 years. So in that particular case, you have an asset. You have a piece of paper. You can do due diligence on. Is this person real? Does his medical records support that this care was done? Does his insurance actually cover it, or whatever the payer is? Is the payer on the hook to cover it? And what is the time horizon for coverage, right? And then what can we pay for it? So you have the ability to look something and this asset, again, not brick and mortar, but an asset that's a legal asset. And the industries of legal and healthcare, they tend to just go steady try. They don't ride these wild waves like real estate does in valuations. They just tend to stay consistent, right? Medicals guys are just busy all the time, regardless of the markets. Attorneys are really busy in good times. They're really busy when people get litigious in bad times. Legal industry tends to be consistent. So you don't expect a huge amount of volatility through broader market conditions in this paper, but you can buy a large number of these receivables, and you can take time to collect them, and you can have services and processes to even speed it up much faster than what the doctors would, because they're focused on care, right? That's what they're passionate about. That's what they like to do, not chasing the companies to get paid. And so we fund those practitioners, hospitals, and allow them to get a portion of their funds now and be able to continue on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, makes complete sense. And as you're talking through it all, like my question comes to my head of like, what's been the biggest thing you've learned when you mentioned the waves and we're riding a bit of a wave now in commercial multifamily? What's been the biggest lesson? You mentioned you had some scars from 08. You've got some little bit of scars from now. What's been that biggest lesson in regards to the real estate element of the business that you've could have told yourself back in 2007?
Stick to the path of making sure that you're truly allocated into what we call non-correlated alternatives, right? Don't get so excited and energized about one specific asset class that you forget to zoom out. Because in industries like real estate, it happens every 10 or 15 years, wild rides. We just happen to have a crazy black swan event this time in commercial, and it had a very tough time. And so looking back, if you just take a step back and say, like, who are the people that are succeeding? I wish I had the education that I have now, or how are the hedge funds, how are the sovereign funds, how are the family offices, how are they allocating? In our decks, we show like 25% in real estate, right? It's a pretty big allocation, right? But it's not all of it. So where's the rest of the 75, right? Stocks, bonds, and one piece. How favorable actually are you about those right now? I mean, I'm not. Macroeconomic instability is pretty strong. What are those other lesser known alternatives which provide that recession resilience and non-correlation? And that's what I wish somebody was educating about then.
And sorry to interrupt you. So Investing Mastery teaches folks that, right? That if they go to your website, they can figure out a little bit more. On that pie, in your 2 cents, in your knowledge, what you mentioned 25% and I can't remember what you mentioned for stocks, bonds, and mutual funds, but what does that look like on a pie? Like the run of the mill family office hedge fund. How are they typically diversified across those, you know, call it half a dozen different buckets?
Yeah. So I just got done speaking at the Family Office Club Hawaii retreat, and I went around talking to the family office guys, asking them about their allocation strategies and non-correlation. And man, there was some wild things. Some were just, no, we only do venture. And I'm like, what do you mean you only do venture capital? I'm like, how is that? No, we're just real estate guys. There is a lot of, I would just say family offices specifically, if they're run their own family office, hard to say. I can't really speak for those guys. But I mean, if you look at the published data for more aggregated, you know, there is 25% in real estate, 25% in business equity. So about half in alts, right? Whereas you have about 11% in cash equivalents, and then the rest kind of in commodities, right? Fixed income and stocks and bonds. And so I actually find myself somewhere similar. Like, I have a substantial amount in cash and cash equivalents, more so in gold and silver, right? Because that I believe to be a hedge against the falling dollar. And that's worked out really well for me over the last 3 years. Like, it's really done well, right? But, and then I tend to be a little less than, you know, 45-50% in the stocks, bonds, and commodities, because I'm actually not very favorable right now about how the global economic macro outlook is. We've got wars going on, BRICS has taken over, we had interest rates were rising, debt spiraling out of control still, all the while the world's biggest economies are betting against the dollar, and our government is not gaining in respect. In fact, people are betting against us, because that's why gold internationally is, they're buying gold internationally, because they're worried about stability. So I don't pretend to be the guy that can like forecast, but I am the guy that looks back as the engineer and I'm like, holy crap, I should know better, because the markets go on these waves. So, you know, the best time to diversify is 2 years ago. Like, what about today? Like, what should I do today? And so I tend to look some of these larger pie charts, and some people are more favorable about public equities than me, and I tend to put a little more into the non-correlated. Also, it's also because I run a platform that educates on. I mean, you don't have 50 different alternatives. Have you been on it yet?
I need to get on it.
I'm going to say it right after this. We're going to get you on it. But I mean, we've educated on this about everything from all kinds of timberland investing, cannabis, forex, gold mining, way to kind of like gold futures. It's really interesting. Just about every kind of real estate under the sun, pilot education, how to buy a plane for cash flow, like just an immense number of very interesting alternatives. And one of the ones was CPA firm acquisitions. And I commend you, Reed, for finding your way down that path, because I frequently tell people that education, healthcare, CPA firms, plumbers, HVAC, they all have that same needed in good times and bad times, recession resilience and non-correlation. So you're right on track there, man, with that asset class. I'm jealous.
Yeah. Well, look, hey, I'm jealous to hear all the cool things you're doing. I think is in a day, there's only so much we can pick up as a firm. But I also, when I personally look at and I'm heavily in multifamily, you know that. But I think one of the big things that we don't talk about in multifamily, and one of the things you can measure quite well, is ambiguity, right? So when I talk about ambiguity, like 10 years ago, and I just talk about the real estate world, and this is across a lot of different asset classes in real estate, you know, DocuSign, or getting someone to sign via DocuSign was a cool thing, right? Today, technology has decreased that ambiguity. It's decreased the unlikelihood of not knowing, right? I look at rents. 10 years ago, I had to call people and see what the person down the street was renting for. I needed that data to sort of set my rents. Today, like at a click of a button, there's a lot of software out there that can really hone in what a studio should rent for, what this should rent for, what that for, and that decreases ambiguity. When I go over to the accounting world, the ambiguity there is so large because there isn't a software that can just say, hey, tell me what all the different CPAs are charging for and what sort of stuff. And we think that, you know, our thesis in the CPA world is CPAs are very sticky, right? You don't see a lot of people jumping around, and they're very loyal. And so if you can provide a slightly better service, a slightly better back-end operations, better marketing, and I'm coming into very old school mom and pop owned assets where they've been owned for 20, 30 years, and they don't even have a link on their website to pay online. Like, this is how antiquated it is. And I think when you go into any alternative investing, understanding where are we at with ambiguity in that particular industry and how is it ripe or not ripe for technology to disrupt that. I'm not saying there's one right answer, but I definitely now look at my investments as, well, how's the ambiguity in this? And can I profit from that ambiguity? Because, you know, you just mentioned buying a plane for cash flow. Like, I've got no idea how big that is, but I could imagine, well, my first thing is, there's a whole industry about flying across the globe. Maybe there is a lot more people in there and maybe the technology will come to there. So, you know, but you just got to, scratch the surface and ask yourself, where is that ambiguity and how does it lie and what is disrupting that industry? So, you know, taking my experience from multi, I think has been a lot around technology has really disrupted and has contributed to where we are today in a quote-unquote rut. There was a black swan event, but there's a myriad of other things that I could talk about that I wish I had got out of 2022. You know? So that was my rant there. But it's interesting as you educate folks across the different spectrums, having that, at least for my two cents, having that lens about where the ambiguity lies and where you can profit from it. So with that being said, at the end of every show, we love to ask our guests, you know, what do you see for the next 12 months? You mentioned, and we'll get into the top five investing tips. What do you see the next 12 to 24 months in where we are in the economy, both US and globally? You know, do you see any more black swan events happening? Like, where does Patrick Grimes? You know, is he sitting in a bunker or is he on the beach enjoying life? Like, what's going on there?
Well, it's Honolulu in the background here. So in the foreground, there's about 500 servers riding one wave in all at one time in Waikiki Beach here. So I reserve that view for me. Sorry, Reed. But I'm a little bit of both. I'd say I'm not a bunker guy. I'm not a doomsday guy, although this engineer in me does like to prepare. That's why I think allocations into metals is so critical, right? Because you need to have reserves and it can't be just in cash. But cash equivalents. The economy is going to do great as long as we keep pumping trillions of dollars into our debt, which is unfortunately creating a much harder landing for us when we actually start taking responsibility for the cash we're spending. So these massive government spending bills are going to continue to prop up the economy because, I mean, we're not getting an ROI. We're just spending and getting a minor percent of that back in GDP. So I think we're going to continue to get propped up. Over the next year outlook, things are favorable, right? I mean, I don't think many people are going to argue too much about that. You can't, I mean, we're artificially propped up, but yeah. My general sense is there's a lot of indicators. I think you were alluding to some of them right now, which are troubling, more so than have been in the past. Right. I think you did mention the black swan. There's wars going on. The spending we talked about, the rise of the BRICS nations, betting against the dollar. China is tightening their grip on vital resources that we need. And so the instability of the United States has the national security and our infrastructure has been exposed. Right. More so it has been. Tide recedes. Can see us swimming naked. And fortunately, the United States is one of those guys that didn't walk protected moving forward and we're a bit exposed. So I'd say in the 10-year, I'd be a little bit more worried. But I think it really doesn't matter. I think you should still be on the beach enjoying every day. Like that's why I'm here and I can wrap up around 3 or 4 p.m. because it's 7 or 10 p.m. Pacific or East Coast time and I can spend every day with the family and my 2.5-year-old. But in the meantime, I can begin deliberately and calculably allocating into more resilient asset classes. So when there's a tumble in one, it doesn't affect the overall portfolio. That's kind of my outlook, Reed. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, that does. It does. And I think it's important there to keep you get so stuck into doom and gloom, but you also got to enjoy why were you started to do this in the first place. And for me, financial freedom, financial education, I think that if you keep that core to who you are, the swings and roundabouts will come. We, you know, I think as investors, we can't read a crystal ball, and the world economy, the US economy, the whatever, it's out of our control. And so in trying to not have so much mental anguish around it, you know, when we're trying to make proper investment decisions, just trying to make data-backed decisions. And I think looking back at the history is a really good indication of what's going to proceed in the future. As they say, it doesn't match, but it sometimes rhymes. So with that being said, we'd like to dive into top five investing tips. You ready to get into it?
Oh, you got some gotcha questions. Hi,
well, no. Okay, quick lightning round. Quick lightning round. So question number one is, what's the daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
I'm an engineer, so I like to think and comprehend, but this is an easy one. I run every single morning, and I listen to leadership books, investing books, self-help books, all kinds of stuff, and that really helps me start my day on the right foot.
Love it. Question number two, who's been the most influential person in your career?
Wow, there are a lot. You know, maybe it is that very first guy that said, hey, don't go put your money in these startups, go put it into alternatives, back when I was an engineer, which led to my initial downfall, which actually built a meaningful career in alternatives. So I think that would probably be it.
Gotcha. Question number three, what's the most influential tool in your business? Could be software or physical. What is it?
It has to be ChatGPT right now. I'm having a hard time imagining how I survived without it before. But yeah, ChatGPT, 1,000%.
Love it. Second to last one, in one sentence, the biggest lesson you learned from your biggest failure.
Learn to partner. Yeah, because in one sentence. Love short it. Sentence. Yep.
Love it. Last question. Where can people reach you to continue the conversation? In your sphere, where do they go?
Passive Investing Mastery, all spelled out, .com. Passive Investing and then Mastery.com. We have our educational platform. Join that. Join our series. Every week or two, we're educating on completely different alternatives. In fact, we're doing one this Saturday, tomorrow, on turnkey rentals. I was buying single family, renovating them and refining and repeating, lost all my hair. How about just doing turnkey rentals? We dive into all kinds of different strategies with panels of experts who've been doing it. Love to educate it. I'm an engineer, loves to learn, and I love to share that education. So dive in there. If you're interested in any of our investments, they're there on that page, right? Private credit, real estate, debt. We have medical coming up and legal. So jump in there, but set up a call. Love to chat with you. One of the things that I love now that I've gone down this journey and I've left my engineering career behind is I always have time on my calendar for investors, for aspiring investors or wherever you're at. And that if anything is kind of rung true with you right now about, hey, you know what, it does make sense. Maybe if I could allocate a little bit into some of these other assets, some of these other asset classes, or, you know, I've got exposure to over 50 different alts. So we'll find something that's a good fit for you. We'll get you pointed in the right direction if we're not the stop. But I love investing back into people. So set up a time. Let's have a conversation.
Awesome, mate. Well, look, I want to thank you so much for jumping on today's show. Just for quickly reflecting, you pretty much summed it up just there. But yeah, having the ability to continue to be curious about the different investments that are out there and really having a focus on alternatives. Kudos to what you're building. And I wish you all the best. Enjoy the rest of your week. Enjoy Honolulu. Enjoy that view. And we'll catch up very, very soon.
Thanks for having me, Reed.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with everything going on in Patrick Grimes' world. If you want to check him out, please go over to Investing Passive Mastery, correct, Patrick?
Passive Investing Mastery.
PassiveInvestingMastery.com. You can also just Google his name because he is everywhere, all over the internet. If you do like this show, the easiest way to give back is to give it a 5-star review on iTunes. I want to thank you all again for taking some time out of your day to continue to grow your financial IQ. It's what we're all about here. So we'll do it all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.